Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, March 24, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing the Smarter Sentencing Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and, as always, we're recording the call for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear from two experts today with only the typical brief introduction, so we'll get right to the substance. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of about 10 to 15 minutes, then some back and forth between our panelists, and then, as always, we'll be taking questions from the audience, so please be ready with your questions. We're going to hear first from Professor William G. Otis. He's an adjunct professor of law at the Georgetown University Law Center right here in Washington, D.C., and he'll be followed by Mr. John G. Malcolm. He is the director and the Edward Gilbertson and Sherry Lindbergh Gilbertson Senior Fellow at the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, also right here in Washington. And with that, Mr. Otis, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean. It's a pleasure to be in on this teleforum, and I'm particularly grateful to have a debate partner of the quality of John Malcolm, whose long years of service in the Reagan administration and elsewhere are a great achievement. I'm very happy that we have him here as well. Speaking of Ronald Reagan, I have to start out by saying that it's hard to recognize Ronald Reagan's America. In the landscape we see today, President Reagan believed in strength and resolve, accountability for bad actors, whether foreign or domestic. What we see now is doubt, decline, and retreat. Retreat as the not-so-former Soviet Union invades the Ukraine, Syria slaughters Christians, and at home, the administration twists itself into a pretzel, trying to find ways to be nicer to drug pushers. The Smarter Sentencing Act is widely said to be overdue, quote, reform in federal law. It would be more honest to say what it actually does. What it does is retreat. It's less a reform than a slashing, by half, of the minimum sentences for traffickers in a huge variety of dangerous drugs. Its most direct and immediate beneficiaries will be, not the public, but heroin dealers. It would give more power to naive or ideologically driven judges, for whom no criminal is without an excuse, and pave the way for the creeping return of irrational disparity in sentencing. In so doing, it would all but dismantle the last monument of Reagan's signature achievement in criminal law, the system of determinant sentencing. When Eric Holder and a politicized Department of Justice tell us the system is broken, they're not telling the truth. As determinant sentencing and existing mandatory minimums have taken hold over the last generation, crime is down by 50%. Not only is the system of determinant sentencing not broken, it is very likely the most successful domestic initiative of the last 50 years. For a tiny fraction of the money we have spent on welfare and other domestic programs, we have achieved, through more serious and uniform sentencing, an improvement in public well-being. Other kinds of social spending, though far greater, have not even approached. The criticisms of existing mandatory minimums are familiar by now, that they have helped swell the prison population, are excessively harsh, target nonviolent offenses, disproportionately harm minorities, and inappropriately tie the hands of judges. None of this is true. The attacks have gained traction only because the critics ignore how rigorous mandatory sentencing came about, how it actually works, and how widespread its benefits have been. Two generations ago, in the 60s and 70s, federal law had an indeterminate sentencing system, that is, a system with no mandatory guidelines or statutory minimum sentences. We were convinced that rehabilitation often works and that we can trust judges to get it right at sentencing with only tepid or no binding rules from Congress. We got something for our trouble. We got a national crime wave. Between 1960 and 1980, crime went up by over 300%. It was twice what it is now. Whole neighborhoods in our major cities had become free fire zones, largely because of the gunplay inevitably associated with drug dealing. In the 80s, Congress got the message and embraced determinate sentencing. That meant, for a few very serious offenses, child pornography, firearms trafficking, and drugs, including methamphetamine, PCP, cocaine, and heroin, that Congress embraced mandatory minimums below which the judge cannot go. Although seldom mentioned in the current critiques, the country got something vital in exchange for the reforms that made sentencing conform to law instead of taste. From the early 90s to the present day, we have enjoyed a massive reduction in crime to levels not seen since the baby boomers were in grade school. This increase in our ability to live in peace and safety has been a moral and an economic boon. According to Bureau of Justice statistics, there are more than 4 million fewer serious crimes per year in America today than there were a generation ago before mandatory minimums came into the law. The financial benefits alone of having so much less crime are enormous, but are never taken into account by those who want to cut back on the relatively small cost of imprisonment. But most important are the human benefits. Crime reduction and our success in squelching the crack wars of the 80s has especially helped the disadvantaged. The hundreds, if not thousands, of people who were being shot down in the streets of our big cities were mostly members of minority groups. Just as they were disproportionately victims of crime in those days, they have been disproportionately the beneficiaries of the drop in crime as stiff mandatory drug sentencing has taken hold. It's true that sentencing laws and increased imprisonment have not alone produced these benefits, but they have contributed significantly. The late Professor James Q. Wilson agreed with other scholars, including those in the University of Chicago study, who found that increased imprisonment in the 90s accounted for a quarter or more of the decrease in crime. The most prominent arguments for slashing today's successful sentencing system miss the mark because they share a single powerful misconception, that a bigger prison population is per se a bad thing. One might as well say that having more criminals behind bars rather than in your neighborhood is a bad thing. When criminals are not incarcerated, they don't disappear. Studies over many years have shown that the great majority of them go back to crime. Those proposing to cut the prison population through watered-down sentencing seldom deal seriously with this fact. If we cut sentencing now, we'll repeat what happened when we cut it in the 60s and 70s. We'll get more crime. Those backing the Smarter Sentencing Act say, however, that we can safely reduce sentences for, quote, nonviolent drug offenses. The unspoken premise is that drug transactions conducted without a gun aren't all that serious. But the question for punishment purposes is not just whether there was violence. The question is whether there was harm. The trafficking and consumption of hard drugs is one of the most harmful and socially destructive enterprises going on in America today. Even if a particular drug defendant does not engage in violence, his participation in the drug business creates the condition in which history tells us that violence is certain to occur. The crack wars were not a myth, and neither is the gunplay that is still a commonplace feature of drug conspiracies from the leaders to the street dealers. Let me give an analogy. Sometimes people ask me why mere consumers, as opposed to producers, of child pornography should get long sentences. The answer is that the consumers build the market in which the producers thrive and profit. A malefactor properly bears culpability for the harms he knowingly facilitates, not just those he directly causes. While many drug crimes are, quote, nonviolent because they are consensual sales, they are anything but non-harmful. Indeed, they can be lethal and often are. Recently, the actor Philip Seymour Hoffman died as a result of what was almost certainly a, quote, nonviolent sale to him of heroin. But he's just as dead as if he'd been shot through the head. So are the 13,000 to 14,000 heroin addicts who overdose every year. Selling heroin to an addict has the same moral valence as selling a loaded gun to a desperate suicidal man, but results in vastly more fatalities. It is in part for these reasons that the National Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys has come out against the Smarter Sentencing Act. Assistant U.S. attorneys are career prosecutors, non-political appointees hired in administrations of both parties who do the department's day-to-day work in grand juries and in courtrooms. They have taken the unusual and, for them, the risky step of publicly opposing the Attorney General and his support for this bill because they know that it will drastically handicap their efforts to break down and prosecute the bigger and more violent drug conspiracies that states hand off to the federal government. Finally, let me address the argument that existing law routinely traps low-level defendants in wildly excessive sentences. That's not so. Existing law provides at least four escape hatches for deserving defendants facing a mandatory minimum. First and most commonly, they can plea bargain their way to a lesser charge. Such bargaining is overwhelmingly the way federal cases are resolved, and, as you would think, the most lenient bargains are offered the least culpable offenders. Even if convicted under a mandatory minimum charge, however, the judge on his own can sidestep the sentence if the defendant has a minor criminal history, has not engaged in violence, was not a big-time player, and makes a clean breast of his crimes. This safety valve, as it's known, has been in the law for almost 20 years and has helped over 70,000 defendants escape mandatory minimum sentencing. Separately, under existing law, a defendant can avoid a mandatory minimum by helping prosecutors bring his cohorts to justice. Prosecutors correctly regard this as an essential tool in encouraging cooperation and thus breaking down large drug conspiracies. Finally, for very unusual cases, the cases we hear so much about in the news, there is presidential clemency. Only recently, the president exercised this power, granting to inmates convicted of crack cocaine offenses the second largest number of commutations in a single day in 43 years. With the president's power as the ultimate fail-safe, based on individual circumstances, there is no need and considerable hazard in adopting the broad-brush approach the present legislative proposals embrace. The question we face, ultimately, is whether we're going to lose our nerve, to retreat, to turn away from a system we know succeeds, to reenact one we know fails. Forgetfulness about our past blunders and complacency about the crime reduction we've achieved are not the way to go. We already tried watered-down sentencing and hoping for the best with the vicissitude of 600 different federal district judges. We found that it confounds the rule of law, overestimates judicial discipline, and endangers the public. Now is no time to go back to the bad old days. And now let me turn it over to John Malcolm.
Thank you, Bill. I'd also like to thank the Federalist Society and my good friend Bill Otis for agreeing to do this debate. I'm not going to defend this administration's drug prosecutions or the Department of Justice in general. I would, however, like to talk about what the Smarter Sentencing Act does and what it doesn't do and why I support it. And by the way, I'm a former assistant U.S. attorney, and others, including Mike Lee, who's a former assistant U.S. attorney, were one of the sponsors of the Smarter Sentencing Act. So to cover ground that most of the people on the call probably know, current minimum mandatory sentences, and we're only talking about drug minimum mandatory sentences, by the way, the Smarter Sentencing Act does not deal with all the other mandatory minimum sentences that are in the criminal code. They are based primarily on the drug amount as a triggering event. So, for instance, if you possess 1 gram of LSD, which is less than a teaspoon, or 5 grams of methamphetamine, that triggers a 5-year mandatory minimum. If you possess 5 grams of LSD or 50 grams of methamphetamine, which is still, by the way, less than 2 ounces, that triggers a 10-year mandatory minimum. And if this is your second offense, then you can get a 20-year mandatory minimum. There are really 2 ways out. Bill said there were 4 ways, but there are really 2 ways out from the mandatory minimum. One way, he said, which was charge bargaining, so that you don't end up getting charged with the mandatory minimum. I don't think that's separate from a minimum mandatory, and I don't count presidential clemency as a way out from under a mandatory minimum. But essentially, there are 2 ways out, both of which Bill mentioned. One was to get a substantial assistance departure motion from the government for cooperation, and the second is to qualify for the safety valve. Now, the safety valve, in order to qualify, the offender needs to satisfy five objective criteria. The first is he has to disgorge whatever information he has, although the government probably already has that information, but he needs to cooperate with the government and tell the government everything he knows about the offense. He cannot be an organizer, leader, manager, or supervisor of the drug activity. So we are talking about the lowest of the low levels, your street dealers, your mules, and your couriers. The offense cannot have involved in any serious bodily injury or death. The fourth is there can have been no possession of a dangerous weapon, a firearm, a knife, and no credible threats of violence. And the fifth criterion is that you can't have any more than one criminal history point. What does that mean? You get a criminal history point by having a conviction, any conviction, that results in a sentence of less than 60 days. So if you have a prior record and you were sentenced to more than 60 days, you do not qualify under the existing safety valve. The first of the five things that the Smarter Sentencing Act would do would be to modestly expand this last criterion from one criminal history point to two criminal history points, which means that you could have two sentences of under 60 days, or one sentence of greater than 60 days, but less than 1 year, so long as none of those offenses were for violent crimes. So the first thing the SSA does is modestly expand that sentencing valve. The second thing the Smarter Sentencing Act does is it says that if you were sentenced prior to the Fair Sentencing Act under the old 100-to-1 crack cocaine, powder cocaine disparity, which was reduced to 18-to-1. So if you were sentenced under the old regime, you can petition a court. The court doesn't have to grant the petition, but you could petition a court for a sentencing reduction if you would qualify for one under the post-Fair Sentencing Act regime. The third thing the Smarter Sentencing Act does is it would reduce those minimum mandatory levels from 5, 10, and 20 years to 2, 5, and 10 years. The fourth thing the Smarter Sentencing Act does, which Bill did not mention and I assume is a provision he does not object to, is it actually creates some new mandatory minimum sentences and enhances some existing mandatory minimum sentences for sexual assault offenses, federal domestic violence offenses, so obviously there has to be an interstate nexus, and also for terrorism-related offenses. And the fifth thing the Smarter Sentencing Act does, which has nothing to do with mandatory minimum sentencing, but which is a good thing, is it would require the Attorney General to identify throughout the entire U.S. Code every criminal provision, would require the Attorney General to say how many times prosecutions have been brought under that provision over the last 15 years, and to identify what the mens rea requirement is for each of those criminal provisions. It would also require regulatory agencies to do the same thing for criminal regulations that fall under their purview, and it would then require the Attorney General and all of those regulatory agencies to make those lists available on their websites free to the public. So, what the Smarter Sentencing Act does not do is it does not eliminate any mandatory minimum penalties. It, in fact, creates some new mandatory minimum penalties, and it does not reduce any statutory maximums for any drug offenses. So any drug offender who is before a sentencing judge, the judge now has full discretion to throw the book at that offender if the judge wants to. There are, in fact, many conservative groups. Bill mentioned the National Association of Prosecutors, and that's certainly true. They have come out against the Smarter Sentencing Act, but there are a lot of solid conservatives. As I said, mentioned Mike Lee and Ted Cruz, also groups like Heritage Action, Americans for Tax Reform, Justice Fellowship, Texas Public Policy Foundation, Major City Chiefs Association, the International Union of Police Associations. This is a bipartisan effort. There are a lot of conservative organizations that think that this makes sense. Now, let me state, I don't like drug dealers. All of the things that Bill said about drug dealers doing harmful conduct, I agree with completely. I prosecuted drug dealers back in my day, and they deserve to be punished. The question here becomes, by how much? Since the creation of mandatory minimum sentencing, federal prison populations have grown by 800%. And like Bill, I do not argue that more people incarcerated is necessarily a bad thing. Half of the offenders, however, in federal custody today are there for drug offenses. It is also a fact that the Bureau of Prisons currently takes up 25% of the Department of Justice's budget, and it's projected to grow to 30% by fiscal year 2018. And that does not include the additional nearly 5% of costs that go to the Marshals Service. Federal prisons are also approximately 40% over capacity at the moment, projected to grow to 44% by fiscal year 2018. The Department of Justice's budget has modestly shrunk over the last several years, and I think it is very safe to say that we are not about to embark on a major prison building expansion program. If that is the case, I view each and every one of those prison cells as very, very valuable real estate that ought to be occupied by the people who pose the greatest threat to public safety. It does not make sense to me, given these budgetary realities, that we lock up first-time nonviolent drug offenders for 5 and 10 years occupying a prison cell where somebody, where there are violent offenders and recidivists and people out there who pose, to my mind, far greater risks to the public safety, who richly deserve to be in those cells. Shorter sentences of 1, 2, and 3 years for a lot of these drug offenders may be more than sufficient to satisfy the penological goals that we set for our prison systems, and that's why I support the Smarter Sentencing Act. I have other things I can say, but I'm sure that they will come up during Q&A, and with that, I turn it back over to you, Dean.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I do want to give Bill Otis a chance to respond and then John to re-respond, but let's open the floor to questions and let people begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who rings in here, let me make our typical announcement. Tomorrow at 4 p.m., we're going to revisit the Hobby Lobby case. That is the HHS mandate case, the Conscience Clause mandate case from the Affordable Care Act. It's being argued in the court tomorrow. We'll have a Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum tomorrow at 4 p.m. with two of our experts who are going to be attending the oral argument. But today we're speaking to Bill Otis and John Malcolm. If you have a question for them, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. Let's go to that first caller.
Hey, this is Rod Sullivan at Florida Coastal School of Law. I guess I want to direct my question mostly to Bill Otis. And I want to preface it by saying that in the 1980s, I would have been arguing Bill Otis's point against John. And over the course of the years between then and now, I've totally switched my mind. I was for fully determinant sentencing and mandatory minimum sentencing back then. And now I guess I've seen it's gone too far the other way. And I guess the question I have for you, Bill, is what is the evidence that the drop in crime rate is due to mandatory minimum sentences as opposed to something else? And I preface it with this. Florida has a very punitive statute called 1020 life that requires people to be put in jail for 20 years if they fire a firearm in committing a felony. We have a woman here named Marissa Alexander who's been in the national news. She fired a quote-unquote warning shot at her ex-husband. There were two children in the room. She has been sentenced to 20 years. Now she's going to be retried. If she's convicted again, she'll be sentenced to 60 years. But she has no prior criminal history, never hit anybody, put one shot into the wall. Should she spend the rest of her life in prison? Getting back to the crime rate question, crime in Florida is down 50% in the last 20 years. And is that attributable to tougher sentences or not? And if you compare 1020 life states with non-1020 life states, they've all had the same decline in crime. So why do you say that mandatory minimum sentencing is responsible for the decline in crime?
Bill, this is Dean. Let me interject here. Why don't you take that question, and also, I mean, if you want to respond to John Malcolm before you take that question, or just roll it all into one.
Let me respond to the question first, and then I will respond to John as well. If it is now the case that there is no relationship between punishment and crime, it will be for the first time in the history of civilization. We've known since civilization began that there is a relationship between punishment and crime. Academic studies have borne out that the tougher and more determinate sentencing that we have had, certainly in the federal government and in most states over the last generation, has resulted in less crime. The principal study showing this is a study done by Professor Steve Levitt at the University of Chicago that showed that an increase in incarceration has resulted in a quarter or more of the decrease in crime. As I was mentioning in my initial remarks, the decrease in crime has been remarkable. We now have 4 million fewer serious crimes per year than we did a generation ago in the early 1990s. If a quarter of that is due to the increase in incarceration, and of course mandatory minimum sentencing has contributed significantly to the increase in incarceration, then there are a million fewer crime victims today than we would have had without it. I don't know why we want to step away from, to retreat from a sentencing system that has worked, to go back to one we know didn't work, when we just left it to the judge and we thought rehabilitation succeeded. We now know that leaving it to the judge results not merely in irrational disparity, it also results in sentences that do not reduce crime. The principal problem that the public is concerned with is not the incarceration rate, it's the crime rate. And I think it's pie in the sky just to think that the crime rate and the substantial reduction in the crime rate over the last 20 years has nothing to do with the kind of sentencing that we've had over the last 20 years. Now let me go on to
Bill, this is Dean. If I could just interrupt, let me go to John Malcolm and see if he wants to respond on this point before you respond more generally to his opening remarks. Okay. I apologize. I jumped the gun here on this, but John, do you have anything on that point?
Yeah, I do. I agree with Bill that harsher sentencing has something to do with the reduction in crime. The studies that I've seen don't say 25% or more. They say up to 25%. But, you know, however you slice it, that's still a considerable number. I would point out, however, that there are lots of states, not in liberal states, many conservative states such as Texas and South Carolina and Michigan, many states over the last several years, 17 of them to be precise, have eliminated or reduced their mandatory minimum sentences. Another 18 have expanded the equivalent of their safety valve, and crime rates in virtually all of those states has continued to drop. Texas has eliminated almost all of its mandatory minimum sentences. Crime rates are at the lowest rates where they've been since 1968. Michigan did the same for its drug offenses and even applied it retroactively in 2002. And violent crime and property rates have continued to drop. So I agree with Bill that there is a link, but I do think you hit a point of diminishing returns where the marginal benefit is outweighed by some of the costs.
Now, Bill Lotus, if you want to more broadly rebut
sure.
opening
thanks,
remarks,
thanks
and then we'll go back to Don.
I guess initially I would point out that the experience of several states over several years is, in my view, no match for the experience of 50 states over 50 years. And that experience is that when we have less incarceration, as we did in the 60s and 70s, we have considerably more crime. And when we have more incarceration, as we have had, over the last 20 years, we have considerably less crime. Second thing I would say about that is that crime is a lagging indicator. When you start cutting back on imprisonment, you're not going to see an immediate increase in crime. It's going to take several years. And the third thing is that the kinds of crimes that the states do are different from the kinds of crimes that the feds do. It was my experience in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and perhaps John's as well, that the states will hand over to the feds the really big and violent drug cartels. So the fact that states have been able to risk more crime by cutting back on sentencing, it seems to me, to the extent that can be relied upon at all, given how few states and how few years this has been going on, doesn't say that much about what is going to happen if you tried the same thing with a more organized, better financed, and more violent kind of criminal that winds up getting federally prosecuted. The other points that I would make in response to John is, first, I would not dismiss two of the four mechanisms for deserving defendants to evade a mandatory minimum. That is charge bargaining and presidential clemency. Charge bargaining is by far the principal method by which defendants who otherwise would face a mandatory minimum escape it. And most of the horror stories you hear about people who, you know, are just engaged in two or three what they characterize as minor transactions and wound up getting sentenced to 50 years or 60 years, those are cases in which they were offered a bargain of 10 or 15 years and turned it down because they thought they could fast talk the jury. It turned out that they were not able to fast talk the jury and wound up with what they thought they would be clever enough to avoid. I have no particular sympathy for that. The second thing I would say to John in respect to, well, the point that prison costs so much and that the Bureau of Prisons budget is now 20% of the department's budget and is going up. The backers, the principal backers of the Murder Sentencing Act, that being Durbin, Leahy, and the other Democrats who provided by far the majority of the votes to get it through the Senate Judiciary Committee, have never once, to my knowledge, cared about borrowing money to do what is really needed for the country. This country lives on borrowed money, and the idea that the minuscule portion of the federal budget that goes toward the Department of Justice, much less toward the fraction of that involved in the Bureau of Prisons, that if we cut back on that, we're going to be doing anything significant about this country's debt problem, I just don't think that's true at all. If we want to cut back on debt, the place to do it is not by cutting back one of the few successful domestic initiatives the federal government has undertaken in recent years. The way to do that is to cut back on the bloated initiatives that don't work, but that cost hundreds or thousands of times of more money.
Could I briefly?
Let's see, I think I had. Why don't we let John respond to that?
Well, I just wanted to say that the vote out of committee was 13-5. It had a vote. It had, you know, support of four Republicans, including Ted Cruz and Senator Flake of Arizona. These are not softy conservatives. And I would say that the fact that there are, so many people, usually over 5,000 a year that qualify for the safety valve, I think belies your argument that the feds are only taking the most serious of the most serious drug offenders. And I would say that there are probably some, but a frighteningly few number who would, facing a large mandatory minimum sentence, turn down a charge bargain that would get them out from under a mandatory minimum sentence. So I think that figure is, in that number, is minuscule in comparison to the number of people who actually get charged and prosecuted for mandatory minimum sentences. Now, that charge bargaining may increase in light of the Attorney General's recent pronouncements, but that remains to be seen.
If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple questions pending. Let me ask each of you, if I could, where are the judges on this, and should we be concerned with where judges are on this? And are there any studies, speaking of empirics, on the frequency with which judges impose the minimum sentence, and is that an indicator that they'd like a lower minimum for a lot of these cases?
I think judges... I can answer that, and then John can have his crack. Judges, the majority of judges are against mandatory minimum sentencing because they want more power for themselves. This is not exactly unknown among employees of the federal government. They want more power for themselves. But again, mandatory sentencing, including mandatory minimums and mandatory guidelines, came into the law during the Reagan years for a reason. And the reason was that judges have shown they cannot be trusted. They showed for 20 years, from 1960 through at least 1980, that they cannot be trusted to impose sentences that will decrease crime. To the exact contrary, they impose sentences that help to increase crime. And the fact that they don't like mandatory minimum sentences, well, that's too bad. The system isn't designed for the approval of judges. The system is designed for the well-being of citizens.
My response to that would be, well, you know, I agree with Bill. I haven't seen the studies, but I would be shocked if there were a majority of federal judges that actually liked mandatory minimum sentences. I assume that most of them don't. I don't consider that much either here or there. I would point out, once more, the Smarter Sentencing Act reduces some mandatory minimum sentences and actually adds some new ones. But in the drug area, it reduces the level of mandatory minimum sentences, but it doesn't eliminate even a single mandatory minimum sentence. So the question that we are talking about here is, what is an appropriate sentence for the kind of conduct that is going on here?
Let's check back in with the audience. We've got three questions pending at this point.
Hi, this is Heather Royce Minus. I'm with Justice Fellowship, and I had a question for Mr. Otis. I was wondering, you cited Mr. Levitt's study, but in 2012, Levitt concluded that the economics of mass incarceration were no longer justified. He was quoted as saying, "We know that harsh punishment lead to less crime, but we also know that the millionth prisoner we lock up is a lot less dangerous to society than the first guy we lock up. In the mid-1990s, I concluded that the social benefits approximately equaled the cost of incarceration. Today, my guess is that the costs outweigh the benefits at the margins. I think we should be shrinking the prison population by at least one-third." And I think it's important that we talk about the specifics of the Smarter Sentencing Act, because we're talking about drug offenses. And the study that Levitt, that you cited, does not specifically look into drug crimes. So you said serious crimes were reduced as a result of mandatory minimums, but didn't specify what constitutes serious crime in the study. So my specific question would be, can you give an example, two examples, or even one, of a specific federal drug mandatory minimum that led to a specific reduction in that federal drug crime rate?
Well, my answer is first that the quotation you read from Stephen Levitt did not purport to revoke or in any way contradict his earlier finding that increased incarceration has resulted in a quarter or more, and that is what it says, a quarter or more, not up to a quarter of the decrease in crime. The second is, I would be very surprised, again, if the rule that has been the case since the dawn of civilization, that increased punishment reduces crime, whether that applied to every other kind of crime, but doesn't apply to drug crimes. I just don't think there's any plausible case for believing that. It's like believing the moon is made out of green cheese. It isn't made out of green cheese. When you punish a given activity, then all other things being equal, you will get less of that activity, whether it's drugs, carjacking, or rape.
I don't disagree with what Bill is saying, although I would point out, and it's a minor caveat, but it's one I think worth mentioning, since we're talking, again, not about eliminating mandatory minimum sentencing, but we're talking about the length of time that people are incarcerated, that when you take somebody off of the street, particularly if they somebody who has at most a nominal criminal record, yes, that person is not committing a crime. And so you're sending a message not only of specific deterrence against that individual, but also general deterrence to the public at large that dealing drugs can land you into trouble. However, you are also taking somebody who is often, albeit employed in a bad job, sort of the primary breadwinner and a father in a household, and incarcerating them. And again, I'm not suggesting they don't deserve to be punished, for a very, very long period of time, 5 years and 10 years. And there are lots and lots of studies that show that there is a very bad economic mobility impact on those families. And so actually there are studies that in certain urban areas, when you incarcerate one person, you can in fact lead to an increase in crime because a whole bunch of other people that relied on that person for some financial well-being also turned to crime. But that's a minor caveat. I don't take big, you know, serious issue with what Bill says.
If you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, my name's Thelma Tormina, and I'm an organizer of a grassroots organization in Texas. I'm a lay person. So my question is, where is the loss of common sense where if people know that they're coming up against a certain sentence and it's mandatory, that it would deter them from doing the crimes that they're doing, irregardless to how much of a grievance it is against society?
I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure I understand the question. You're saying why, if somebody's facing a minimum mandatory sentence, why would a rational person continue to engage in that activity? Is that your question?
No, why would we stop having the mandatory sentencing? In other words, if you know you're going to do a crime and you know what the sentence is going to be and it's a super bad sentence, why would we lose the common sense of knowing that if an individual knew what they were up against committing that crime, that they would think twice before they do it?
Because lots of people don't. I mean, many of them are, you know, were you done with your question?
Well, yeah, except for if we go to that rationale and say, well, because some people don't, then aren't we lacking in educating people that they shouldn't be doing these things rather than letting them go free and not do the mandatory sentencing?
Well, first of all, nobody's talking about letting anybody go free. It is a question not of whether they will be punished, but by how much. It is also a fact that there are in large swaths of our country not only a lack of education, but a lack of deferred gratification, if you will. The people, you know, are their addicts. They're thinking only about what they're going to be doing in the next 5 minutes, not thinking what they're going to be doing in the next year or 2 years or 5 years. There are many, many ills that will explain that. And again, I am not suggesting that these people are not engaging in bad conduct. I'm not suggesting that these people should not be punished. It is a question of, at what point do we hit a point of diminishing returns where we are tearing away a nonviolent offender who is granted engaging in a pernicious activity, tearing him out of his community and you know, impacting the families that are there, impacting that person's ability to potentially become a productive citizen, and most importantly, locking that person away in a prison cell, which means that that prison cell is not available for an extensive period of time for somebody who poses a greater threat to public safety.
Bill Otis, anything on this point?
Yeah, if I could, I would have a comment. Number one, I agree with what I take to be the caller's underlying concern, which is, as I was saying in my opening remarks, I think the Smarter Sentencing Act basically signals a retreat from the Reagan era regimen of saying that we're going to enforce individual responsibility, and we're going to say that the problem is not with the system, the problem is with people who want to make a quick buck doing drugs, and if they get caught at it, they have assumed the risk that we're not going to, you know, turn ourselves upside down to think about what they should have been thinking about when they made a decision that the way they want to make a living is through crime. I think John has a somewhat romanticized view of these folks as being, you know, productive citizens who take care of their families. In my days as an assistant U.S. attorney, these drug dealers would frequently invoke their families during allocution. But when the probation officer investigated it, it turns out that he had done such things as, well, he never bothered to marry the mother or mothers of his various children, provided no support to them, and barely ever saw them. And, you know, this is not, you know, the mom and pop picture from the 1950s, or fathers knows best, and that is not who these people are. And let me say one other thing as well, and I'll stop this part of it. John listed an impressively long list of conservative organizations, or normally conservative organizations, that support the Smarter Sentencing Act. But there was one conspicuous omission. He didn't list any conservative organizations that, unlike the National Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys or the National District Attorneys Association, who actually have day-to-day responsibility for neutralizing the drug trade and convicting drug traffickers. The only conservatives who are supporting this are people who are concerned about government spending, and I too am concerned about government spending. I just think we're fooling ourselves if we think that we can reduce government spending by cutting back on the minuscule portion that of the federal budget that is spent on the Department of Justice, much less on the Bureau of Prisons. That may feel good to conservatives. I understand the feel-good aspect of this, but I think conservatives would be better advised to concentrate on saving the budget on these gigantic entitlement and welfare programs that are the real cause of the looming national bankruptcy.
If I may, the Major City Chiefs Association, the International Union of Police Associations, the American Correctional Association, the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, all of whom support the Smarter Sentencing Act, would fit into the category that Bill just mentioned. I also don't believe that I have a romanticized I know that this is an Ozzie and Harriet that we are dealing with, but there are lots and lots and lots of studies that indicate that once somebody is taken out of a household, and particularly once they're, become a felon, and once that they spend a significant amount of time away from their family, and then they have to deal with the problems of reintegrating themselves into society once they are out, that you limit not only the economic mobility of the convicted felon, that's only to be expected, but you dramatically impact the economic mobility of the family members who were innocent. And another point that you made earlier, which I take to heart, you said that a large number of people who get out of jail recidivate, and I believe you said it's at least 50%, and I do want to correct that. It's not right. It's not over 50%. The figure's closer to 30%. Now, 30% is still a very, very high figure. I absolutely get that. But that also means that 70% of the people are not going to recidivate, and they've been in jail now for a very, very long period of time, too long in my opinion. Again, we're not talking about not punishing these people. It's the disproportionality of the sentence that doesn't make sense to me.
We've got two callers pending with questions. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, my name is Billy Freeland. I'm a student at NYU Law. A quick comment and then a question. The comment being, we've talked about plea bargaining as sort of a safety valve out of the mandatory minimum problem, and I just want to emphasize that plea bargaining has actually given more leverage to prosecutors and made it more difficult for people to get what we would think is either a fair sentence or the just sentence. And so what's happening is now, as you guys know, we have 97% of federal criminal prosecutions being resolved by plea bargain. So there is a question as to whether the mandatory minimum and the plea bargaining actually kind of work together positively or not. The question is to Professor Otis. I'm not sure I've quite heard the kind of the rigorous analysis that we need to hear about why these sentences are the right length. And so you've kind of made your analysis around the argument that, tougher sentences lead to less crime. And so my question is, why not increase mandatory minimums? Why not go higher if we're trying to deter crime? How do you draw the line? Because if you can't draw the line, it seems that maybe we should consider lowering the sentences if it's too costly in other areas of society. Thanks.
I'm glad you identified yourself as being from a law school. I teach a law school part-time, and that's the sort of question that I would expect from a law school. It's the old line-drawing question. Well, couldn't we increase them and get yet more decreases in crime, or couldn't we decrease these sentences and maybe we just get a bit more crime? As you'll learn when you start practicing law, line-drawing is always arbitrary. Yes, we could have higher sentences, and in my view, certainly a view that I see as historically validated, we will get less crime, and if we lower sentences, we'll get more crime. That is what 50 years of history teaches us. What I know, rather than speculating and rather than asking law school questions, is that the system we have had in place from the Reagan years forward, that is the system of determinate mandatory sentencing, has worked. It's worked for the primary goal a criminal justice system exists to achieve, and that is a lowering of crime. It has lowered crime substantially. And to think that drug crimes are unrelated to and are not covered by the general reduction of crimes is to show a complete divorce from the reality of what goes on in our courtrooms and what crime actually consists of. Drug crimes are intimately related to violence. They're intimately related to theft. They're intimately related to property crimes of all sorts, to standard sorts of crimes. And John will know this, having been an assistant U.S. attorney, to think you can treat one and not affect the others, and to think that you can cut back on sentencing one and not affect the others is not to be acquainted with the reality that I saw in 18 years as a federal prosecutor.
I would say a couple of things. I would say, again, the Smarter Sentencing Act does not eliminate a single mandatory minimum sentence. It reduces some. It, in fact, adds some new mandatory minimum sentences for violent offenses. So we are talking, again, about a question of degree in terms of not whether somebody should go to jail, but for how long. I would say the caller's question about, you know, do mandatory minimum sentences, not so much plea bargaining, much charge bargaining, which is a form of plea bargaining, I suppose, do they create incentives for people to try to plead out? Yes, mandatory minimum sentences are a very, very heavy hammer. Whether they're an appropriate heavy hammer or not, I suppose, depends on the circumstances. And that's part of what we're debating now, is whether the hammer with respect to these level of offenders is too heavy. And again, in terms of trying to deter crime, I would say that by locking up these nonviolent offenders for 5 years, when a 2-year sentence would most likely suffice, or for 10 years, when a 3 or 4 or 5 year sentence would likely suffice, cost dollars. That's dollars that's not being devoted to police and law enforcement agents on the streets who are out catching dangerous criminals. And once you catch them, there are no prison cells for them. And so I would say, in fact, that by reducing these sentences to a more proportionate level, you are going to free up resources that will then be utilized to catch and incarcerate people who pose a greater threat to public safety than the people who are currently being incarcerated.
We've got one more caller question pending. If you want to add yourself to the list, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Both of my experts here today have advised they can go a couple minutes long here, so we have time for additional questions. Let's now go to our next caller. Go ahead, caller. You might have your telephone muted.
Hello, my name is Molly Gill. I'm with a group called Families Against Mandatory Minimums here in Washington, D.C. And my question is for Mr. Malcolm. I'm just looking here at some data on your average federal drug offender and seeing that, you know, over half of them had little or no prior record. 1 in 5 played a minor role. 94% of them did not play any leadership role in the offense. 85% had no weapon involved in the offense. And last year, under the career criminal enterprise and the continuing criminal enterprise statute, which is our kingpin statute, there were only 10 people actually convicted under that. And yet, most of these people are getting these 5, 10, 20 year or even life mandatory minimum sentences. And I'm just curious to hear you talk a little bit about Congress's intent when they created these laws and whether the data that I just listed is actually what Congress intended to be happening.
Well, you know, look, I won't tread into the murky waters of what Congress intended to have happen. I think that what Congress intended to have happen was to deal with a drug scourge and to reduce crime. So, you know, I think, again, I'm not somebody who is against all mandatory minimum sentencing, and I'm not even against all mandatory minimum sentencing in the area of drugs. It's a question of, as with many, many things, You know, people tend, when it comes to crime, to ratchet to the right because nobody ever wants to be accused of being soft on crime, so they constantly either create new crimes or they dramatically increase the penalties or for the crimes that exist. They don't allocate a lot more money to deal with those situations, but they certainly have no problems creating new crimes and ratcheting sentences to the right. And so now we find ourselves in a situation in which BOP is incarcerating more people for far longer periods of time. The Department of Justice's budget is not growing, and you now have these very large prison overpopulations being taken up with jail cells for people who many of them have, you know, nominal records. They were certainly, you know, not major players in drug organizations, and most of them, not enough of them, but certainly most of them, if they got out, would in fact not recidivate and would have a chance to become productive members of society. And I think that it's rather remarkable that that all of these politicians that are constantly afraid of being accused of being tough on crime are finally coalescing around this issue to say, in this area, perhaps we have gone too far. I think that that is significant, and I agree with it.
Bill Otis, anything on this point?
Yes, I do have something. I'm not aware of any evidence, maybe John can tell me about it if he knows of it, that any jurisdiction in the country, much less federal jurisdiction, is releasing violent criminals early or refusing to accept violent criminals into jail because too many jail beds are occupied by drug offenders. I haven't heard of a single violent criminal who's been released on that account. So I don't think this trade-off is exactly what it's being portrayed. One other thing I want to mention is the figure was mentioned, 97% of federal cases are resolved by plea bargains, and the implication was that these bargains, John did not say this, I think an earlier caller said it, the implication was that these this very large percentage, 97%, is a result of extortion in which federal prosecutors use these very long mandatory minimums to extort people into pleading guilty. That's not true. The reason people plead guilty, I know this, I was there for a long time, the reason they plead guilty is that they are guilty, and they know that the government has the evidence to prove it. They also know that they're going to get a better break by taking by pleading guilty and accepting responsibility than they would be if they went to trial and had the whole bloody mess spelled out in front of an increasingly incensed judge and jury. That's the real reason that people plead guilty. And if, for example, a much lower figure, you know, 60 or 70%, was convicted as a result of a guilty plea, we would hear the opposite, that the government is draconian because it's sweeping up all of these innocent people, but they choose trials because they want to show how the government has made these false accusations. The truth of the matter is that a large percentage of defendants who were plead guilty shows that the system is working and charging people who are guilty. That's what it actually means.
I'd push back on that a little bit. I would sit there and say that I'm sure that Bill is correct, that the vast majority of people who plead guilty are in fact guilty. However, I must say that if I were truly believed that I was innocent and I was being offered a deal that would get me minimal or no jail sentence as opposed to facing a mandatory minimum, even if I was convinced in my heart of heart that I was innocent and even if I thought I had a triable case, I would have to think long and hard before decided to go to trial. And if I, you know, do I think that there are people out there who probably are innocent or at least where the government couldn't prove its case and they take that deal because they don't want to run the risk of rolling the dice and getting stuck with a mandatory minimum sentence? Yes, I think that there are people out there who will like that, probably more than Bill does and probably less than the caller did.
Let me give Bill Otis 60 seconds to wrap up and then we will come back to John Malcolm. Bill Otis.
Thanks, Dean. And again, I appreciate the Federalist Society and John in particular being willing to spend his valuable time to engage on this topic. We've had success. We had a big problem with crime, with a huge increase in crime. Much of it was drug-fueled in the 60s and 70s. We reached a solution in the 80s. under Ronald Reagan. The solution was called determinate sentencing, and the solution worked. Unlike so many solutions that the federal government has come up with over the last generation or two, this is a solution that worked. We have a lot less crime, and it does seem to me that the basic thing that's going on now in wanting to retreat from what we have done is forgetfulness about what a system with dumbed-down sentencing, with less of an emphasis on incarceration, with what that system brought us, and complacency about the successes that we achieved by adopting determinate sentencing in general and mandatory minimums in particular. Those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. The histories of the 60s and the 70s and exploding crime is not one that the public wants to repeat, and it's one that if it is repeated, if we lose our nerve, people will not be happy about.
John Malcolm.
I also want to thank the Federalist Society and for Bill for engaging in this debate on a topic that obviously divides conservatives, but I think a debate like this is robust. I don't think that anybody has forgotten the past. This is not really a question of being soft on crime. It's really a question of being smart on crime. And during tight budgetary times, I think we need to face realities that if we are going to be incarcerating people for considerable lengths of time, that they need to be the right people for the right length of time. I think that the war on crime is on crime is certainly important. The war on drugs is important, but with respect to too many low-level, nonviolent offenders, people who have made mistakes, who deserve to be punished, absolutely, and in some cases quite harshly, but many of whom have lives that are remediable, that perhaps the pendulum has swung too far, and it's time for a minor, modest course correction, and that's what the Smarter Sentencing Act is.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here today, Mr. John Malcolm, Professor William Otis. We certainly appreciate your thoughts, and thanks to the audience for your participation. And an announcement or a note that tomorrow at 4, we'll be revisiting the Hobby Lobby case with a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.